trustee and dissolved. That's not to me. We'll do some other questions in a few minutes. But just a couple of words about the meditation. I know that many people, they try to do things like wash the breath straight away. To wash the breath straight away without any preparation. Would anybody try to wash the breathing at the very beginning? They usually find that if their mind wanders away, they find it takes too much effort or they fall asleep. And the reason is because they're watching their breath too early. You haven't done preparation for washing the breathing. And it's because of that that I did encourage to do a little bit of body awareness, first of all, in order to get you to be aware of your body, so that we can establish a little bit of mindfulness and a little bit of kindness. And watch your body, are you watching your body? You can also relax your body to make it nice and peaceful and comfortable. Which means that when you sit in meditation, you don't always have to sit on the floor. There are chairs in the back, and I'm sure we can find some more chairs if you do need to sit on one. And there are also some places next to the wall. I always notice in my center the places next to the wall are the ones which fill up first. So someone can actually lean against them. There are some pillars, pillars. They've already been taken by the ones who got there first. It is important to have comfort of your body. When the body is comfortable and relaxed and it's not causing you too many aches and pains or irritations, then the body can be let go of and then you can focus on your mind. And as you focus on your mind, it's something which you may have heard me introduce, the peaceometer. You have a speedometer on your car. You have a thermometer to see how hot it is. You have so many meters in life, and this is called the peaceometer, which tells you how peaceful you are inside, or its opposite, how agitated. So before you even start to watch your breathing, if that's the meditation you do, I would ask you, how peaceful are you? Give it a number from 1 to 10. Right now. It does not matter what that number is, only that it does indicate that you're washing a part of your mind which is very crucial. I should have said 1 is really peaceful and 10 is very agitated. 0 means dead. But it tells you roughly how peaceful you are. And then the next job of the peaceometer is what makes the needle of the peaceometer go down closer to 1. In other words, what calms you down? And what makes the needle of the peaceometer go up? What makes you disturbed and agitated where you lose that sense of peace? So now you're understanding the causes of peace, the causes of agitation, of disturbance. And obviously once you know those causes, then see how much you can calm your mind down at the very beginning. And I will be repeating this probably again and again and again during this retreat. You'll always find that when you linger in the past or you run off into the future, that causes a lot of agitation. When you stay in the present moment, it's good enough. find your piece of it that the needle goes down. You'd also find that if you struggle and strive, the needle of the piezometer will go up. But if you just relax and let go and be kind to open the door of your heart for this moment, then the needle will go down. Very simple little exercises where you find out for yourself by watching a piezometer, being mindful of it, what you need to become calm and peaceful. If you've dealt with those basic disturbances of the body and the mind first of all, then if you start watching your breathing, the major disturbances have been dealt with at the very beginning. So it's quite easy to watch your breathing, because you've dealt with the big problems first of all. And you'll also find, surprise, surprise, then you don't need to think so much because you're already calm and peaceful. The thoughts which do disturb many meditators, they are just like waves on the surface of a lake. And trying to pat the waves down and suppress them only makes more waves. So why are there waves anyway? Because the water is agitated. So if you can just learn how to calm the water down, and I'll give many exercises for that later on, starting tomorrow, calm the water down, then you will find that it is not in the thoughts. Because like a lake, if it's not agitated, it becomes calm and peaceful. And so doing things by washing the breath becomes so simple. If watching the breath is hard, it means you haven't done enough preparation. So anyway, that's just a little bit for you. But I will start with the questions in the box. I don't have a clue what these questions are. It always makes it exciting for a monk. See what happens. Hi, Ajahn. During meditation, I watch my breath and at the present moment. I'm not disturbed, I'm not totally happy, but I'm relaxed. Where is my meditation going? Now, where is it going? If it's going somewhere, it will be very disturbed. In other words, we're not trying to go somewhere, we're trying to be here. Now, I've made that comment many times. I travel around to many different places. I was in London recently, and then over in Penang, in KL, yesterday this morning. And all those places I've gone, it's very hard, very rare to see a human being. There are very, very, very few human beings in London. All I saw were human goings, human talkings, human textings, always going somewhere, but never being here. So if we try and get somewhere, then we will be agitated, trying to get somewhere else, not really paying attention to where we already are. And of course, one of the other stories, I just like everybody else, I made mistakes. One day I was going into the office in our city temple, and I met an old friend, and he just said, "How are you, Ajahn Brahm?" And I said the words, "I'm getting there." To which he replied, "Exactly where are you getting to?" And I said, "Oh my goodness, he's called me out." So I told him I'm getting to one of two places, either a grave or a river toilet. That's where I'm going. So before we get to the grave or the river toilet, wouldn't it be wonderful to actually spend time being here instead of going somewhere? And that's the same with meditation. In meditation, please don't try to get somewhere. Instead, try to be here. More content, more happy, more describes a powerful way to develop deep meditation. And in fact, it was Ajahn Chah who said so many times that we meditate not to attain things, but to let go of things. Wonderful little teachings. To let go of things, not to attain things. Now we have material possessions, we also have these days spiritual possessions. How much are you on the path? Where are you? How many jhanas have you got? How many states of enlightenment have you got? How many psychic powers have you got? So that's not the point. The point is, how much have you let go? Renounce. How much are you at peace? And the more you let go, the more you are at peace. So this is why we learn how to see not what we can attain, not where we can get to, but how we can be here. That kind of process. Be in here. Okay. So just stay where you are tonight. The peace builds and builds and builds. It is like if you want to make a house of peace, you have to make that house of peace by laying many bricks one after the other. In this moment, in this moment, in this moment, in this moment. And once you have made many moments of peace, in every moment, you'll find you still have a beautiful house of peace. Now, could I imagine? When in group sitting in the beginning, could you give some guidance what we must do when we meditate? Okay, when you're in a group sitting, just do nothing. You know, that actually is so simple. Except it's the most difficult thing to do, simply because we're addicted to doing things. So that's always what we've been trained as, to do something. To change it, to make something happen, to get rid of things. But just to be in here and finding out what this moment is when one stops trying to change it. This is my first critique, and I don't know how to meditate. Thanks, Ajahn. You are a great advantage not knowing how to meditate. They even call it beginner's mind. Because you don't know what to do, you can't do anything. You just sit there. Woohoo! But I probably will spoil it tomorrow morning, because indeed, tomorrow when we do a group, at 8 o'clock we'll talk, I'll give all the instructions for meditating and spoil it for you. But just be here this moment. Should be very simple. Okay, Ajahn Chah's story. But a Swedish professor came to see Ajahn Chah, must have been about at least 40 years ago. And because people started learning about meditation, and the Swedish government, very advanced, wanted to have some idea what is this meditation. So the professor was paid by the Swedish government and his university to travel to every guru he could find in India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Thailand, to find people to ask, famous meditation teachers. And because it was university, they had to ask the same question so they could measure the answers. So they could write a report, a survey. And so the four questions were, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? Standard questions that you get the answers from all the different experts and collate them and take them back to his government. So, those were the questions. And when it came to Ajahn Chah, I was there at the time, I believe, Ajahn Chah's house. And Ajahn Chah,
Okay.
Just making sure.
Okay, back up. So, when it came to open char, the translator translated the questions into Thai char, and then he did something very strange, which I've only seen him ever do once, and it's on this occasion. He asked for a piece of paper and a pencil. Now, when Ajahn Chah did anything a little bit out of the ordinary, we always knew he was up to something. And it was going to be wonderful, fun, and also probably very deep. So, when he got his pencil and paper, he must have seen other people doing this. Because he lit the pencil, he scratched his head. He thought that's what you're supposed to do when you're making answers for a professor of the university. And so he thought for a while, this is also totally out of character. And then he wrote down the answers. And he gave it to the translator, who had to stop laughing before he could translate it to the English. And the answer to the first question, what is meditation? The great master Ajahn Chah answers as follows, pay attention. What is eating?
Yes.
That's his answer. What is meditation? Ajahn Chah said, what is eating? The answer to the second question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? The third question, how do you meditate? How do you eat? Fourth one, what do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? Well, I thought I'd end this story. I do apologize profusely because I forgot that you don't have any meal this evening. I'll probably make you hungry. So I'm used to a preset form at all. But anyway, that was his four answers. And that professor got very upset. That stupid answer, oh, what's something, you know, deep, profound. And that was deep, that was profound. Because we asked him, how do you meditate? Did anyone ever teach you how to eat? Maybe table manners, yes, but actually how to eat is one of those natural phenomena which we can do even without much training. That should really be how we meditate. Just let go of it. Be still, be in this moment. That's all. And people say, oh, that's not profound enough. I need more instructions. If that's all you do, you get into some very beautiful, peaceful states of mind. Happens naturally. It is here. So that's my other question. Dear Ajahn, how should one deal with internal chatterbox? Just say you deal with external chatterbox, instead of the shower. So look yourself in the mirror and say, me, shower. And of course that doesn't work, but what does work is just learning how to relax some more. And as you relax more and more and more, you find the chatterbox doesn't say very much. If you have somebody else to talk to, maybe you get encouraged to talk. But when there's no one else to talk to, just yourself, you realize how boring you are. You know what to talk to, anyway. Shut up. But more than that, after a while, we learn to be peaceful. So instead of chattering to yourself, instead of that, we listen to ourselves. We don't talk to other people, we don't talk to life. We listen to the world and see what the world, life, has to teach us. See what our body can tell us. We're listening, not talking. Just like when I was over the first few years over in Australia, many Thai people would come to feed the monks. And I still recall in our kitchen, there were six Thai women making our daily meal. And I walked past and I looked through the window. And I counted the six Thai women, all with their mouths open and talking. Because they were cooking. And I started to be close to being a theoretical physicist. That's basically math. And I did a quick calculation. If six people are in the kitchen, only six people, and six people are talking, then there's no one to do the listening. What a waste of time that talking was. And that's so true, isn't it, that sometimes that if it's a talker, at least you have to be a listener. Otherwise, what's the point of talking? So the world is teaching you. It teaches you so much. So listen. Listen to the world. Listen to your body. Listen to how the body reacts. And you learn so much about how the body works. And we stop talking. I mean, inside, stop thinking. And start listening. How to deal with the anxiety due to fear? I experienced fear of unknown, fear of the consequences. I didn't control my emotions because I had a few panic attacks before. Sometimes this thought leads to I find life has no meaning and doubt. What is the purpose of life? Am I thinking too much or experience depression, need your guidance? Thanks. Anxiety attacks, fear, they sometimes they become a habit of the mind. Basically, I would probably imagine it's just neurons firing indiscriminately and creating some fear. Because there's nothing to fear here, especially on this retreat. No fear, Ajahn Brahm is here. And it's, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. Because if it's any, I know that people are afraid of ghosts, but you have much more power over ghosts than ghosts have over you. Sometimes I really sort of, why are people afraid of ghosts? Simply put, it's the same as why an elephant would be afraid of a mouse. Elephants are afraid of mice, actually. Why? I'm not quite sure. Because an elephant can squash a mouse, just like that. A mouse can't squash an elephant. So the elephant has much more power. But because of the tradition, because of the stupidity, is why the elephant is afraid of a mouse. The same way human beings are afraid of a ghost. Real ghosts, if you just go, ghost, out of here. Because you've got far more power just an ordinary human being. Imagine just like a monk, especially a senior monk. You've got huge power. And so those are the ghosts. If they came close, they would run away. I don't know whether I should tell the stories or not, but anyway, just years ago in Thailand, I went looking for the ghosts. One of these monasteries, which was a cremation ground. And when I saw quite a few of them, because there was a lot of them, and I went up to them, just basically to ask them, how are you, basically, just to be friendly. You know what the ghost did? Ah! You can see us? Ah! And they ran. They were terrified. And you know, sometimes I sort of wondered why. You know, I was just trying to be kind. But this is the fact of the matter, that human beings, and especially monks, are way, 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 way more powerful than ghosts. And so are you. So, number one, in this place, if you feel that any spiritual ghost is causing you any sort of trouble, very unlikely any ghost is here without you. You should tell them, if you mess around, if you disturb me, I'm going to inform my temper. And that's not a joke, that's actually very well. But just tell them out. And that means you don't have to be afraid of such things. times a problem. I remember when I was given a bicycle. I was about 10 or 11 years of age. The first time you had a little bicycle, and so I would hold the handlebars so tight out of fear that my knuckles went white. And I was so stiff out of fear that when I went around the corner, I kept falling off. It was a fear, and the inability just to relax, and just the body would move with the bike. That's what kept me falling off. Until I started to learn, just I'll forget about it. And then I just would relax and just go quite easily on the bike. It was a fear that kept pushing me off. But sometimes people do have those chronic anxieties. And this is the story. This is the story of the chronic anxiety and this girl who was in Adelaide University. She was an undergraduate in dentistry, very, very smart girl, but she had anxiety and panic attacks, extreme panic attacks, so much so that she was bedridden. She could not get out of the bed. She'd go to the door and just really have a big panic attack and have to go back to bed. Because she was at university, the student health services provided her with three doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, everything, but nothing was working. So she was still in bed. Her piece of good fortune was that her uncle was a very close disciple of mine in Perth. And so it was her uncle who told her, give her some drama call. And this is what happened. She told me that she was bedridden with anxiety and panic attacks. Can I help? I said, yes. Where do you feel the anxiety? There is in my mind. No, every emotion has a corresponding feeling in the body. That's how it manifests on the body. So, where do you feel it in the body? In my chest. Exactly where in your chest? You're a scientist studying dentistry. I want coordinates. How many millimeters from your navel to its center? And is it right in the center of your breastbone, or is it to the left or the right? How many centimeters to its center? And how far does that feeling spread? Is it a circle or is it an oval? How wide, how on its long side, how wide on its short side? I want a total description of when you have a panic attack and the feeling which manifests the tightness in your chest. I want to know how big it is and where it's located. Give me a call when you can make that answer. And of course, first of all, as many young therapists have told me, it was a wonderful thing to take a little bit of charge over your own healing. So you're not just asking somebody else to do it for you. You actually participate in your healing. So about 3 days later, she called. It gave her something to do. She had plenty of panic attacks to work on. And she said, it was so many millimeters above her navel. So, not central, but just a little bit to the left or right, I can't remember. It was an oval, and not sort of spread up, but started this way, started that way. And she gave me this really interesting description of what she has to panic attacks, and where the physical feeling is located and how it spreads over her body. Great. Now, how does it feel? You know where it is, but now what does it feel like? It's tense, it hurts. Not good enough. I want a detailed description, as if it was an assignment at university, 500 words. Okay, give me a call when you do. And so she did that. She had this really detailed description of how it felt, really tight in the middle, and just it eased off as it got onto the outside, and it throbbed, and it was like being pulled.
chief guard when she had a panic attack. Great. Now, of course, you should have figured out I was really asking her to be more mindful, really mindful of that feeling, not just in my chest and it hurts, really mindful, so to keep someone a long distance away a thorough description. If there's any GPs here, doctors, specialists, what a wonderful thing it would be if, you know, your patient could give such a description to you. It would make treatment much better. And said, I don't feel well, doctor. Well, exactly what? I feel a bit funny. So anyway, actually, there's someone who's asking me about some of the mumps over in Perth, and because you know, in the end of they come here, you go there. And one of the mumps, it's always been like a, I don't know if it's a flu or something, you know, in Perth. But anyway, it reminded me of the story of a gentleman that when he opened the door of his house, someone was knocking on the door of his house one evening, and when he opened it, he saw a 6-foot cockroach outside. 6-foot high, big cockroach. And he was so sort of, before he could even think or say anything, the cockroach touched him. Scurried away. And, you know, he was a bit bruised, but he couldn't tell his wife. If you tell your wife, any husband said, I was assaulted by a cockroach. You know, they'd laugh at you, they'll take you seriously. So he just took it. The next evening, around the same time, the doorbell rang. When he opened, it was a 6-foot cockroach again. And this time, it headbutted him. And, you know, broke his nose, blood came out. And so, really, what's going on? This is strange. He told his wife. You know, this time, wife thought it was crazy, but, you know, it wasn't really much damage, so he just fixed it up. He didn't need to go to the hospital, but the third nose. The doorbell went, and he opened it. The cockroach again. 6-foot huge. And this time, the cockroach stabbed him. So he had to go to the hospital. Well, he told the doctor, and they said, well, doctor, believe me, I'm not crazy, I'm not mad. You know, 2 days ago, I was punched by this cockroach. Just last night, headbutted, and today, I was stabbed by this big cockroach. Real, honestly, I'm not making it up. And the doctor said, oh, it's to be expected. In many cases like that, because there's a nasty bug going around. Cockroach is a bug. Nasty bug. Thank you so much. Anyway, so what she could be mindful of the problem. So the next thing was is to use kindness, compassion, no love. Now, that's one of the reasons why I became a Buddhist because there's such an emphasis on kindness and compassion, forgiveness, gentleness. And to this day, I use that as much as I possibly can. So I said, now you have to do some compassion on that, a physical manifestation of your anxiety. When you have an anxiety attack, take your hand and just massage that area, massage it. Really with much kindness as you possibly can. You know, I'm doing that. It actually feels good even though I'm myself. And he said, if you can't do that because he told me she had a living boyfriend who would actually cook for her, wash for her, do anything for her because she was bedridden. What a wonderful thing that is if you can find a guy like that. And anyway, it's a nice happy ending to the story. So I said, if you can't do it, get your boyfriend to massage you. I don't think he would have checked. And so, give me a call in a couple of days' time. And when she called the next time, I said, did you follow the instructions? Yes. You have an anxiety attack? Did you massage your boyfriend? Said, yes. What happened to the feeling sort of in your chest when it was being massaged? And then we have some, what's called a light bulb, the Eureka moments. But she paused. And that
pause the word knew that she solved the problem. She said, once I massaged it, the physical feeling went away. And the anxiety, that went. So instead of dealing with that on the emotional level, which people find very difficult, do it on the physical manifestation level. Massage the chest until the anxiety disappears. When it does disappear, you find the cause of the anxiety, the emotional problem, that also goes at the same time. And because of that she was, I didn't need to call anymore, she was out of the bed the next couple of days, my uncle was telling me what was going on. And back to studies, she graduated first class honours in dentistry, and about a year later, she insisted, no matter how busy I was, insisted that I go to do the blessing of her work. So the two of them, you know, with my help, and they got her life together again. And so that's obviously when they got married, I had to do the child in order to take anything else. So that was wonderful. You know, she's got a couple of kids now, obviously very, very successful. So it's wonderful you can help people like that. But it's not just for those two people. One of the doctors over in Perth, she was a resident at one of the hospitals, and there was one lady there who was on a ventilator because she had anxiety disorder. She couldn't even breathe properly, so she had oxygen supply all the time. And so she told me that her training was to give her this medication, this drug, that didn't work, another drug, and then they had a whole list of drugs, try this first, and then this, 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 because of her really extreme anxiety. And she said on a Thursday evening, she was about to finish her work and go home, and still this woman had really bad anxiety. And the doctor came up to the last of the medications, didn't know what to do next, and she was rushing to go home. And so, even though it's probably illegal, she decided to teach her Ajahn Brahm method. When you feel anxiety, when it comes up, just start massaging her. And she stopped it very quickly. Then she had to go home to her husband and kid. When she went there the next morning to the ward, the ventilator was off, the oxygen mask was off, they said, I've been good now, I'm going home. It worked! I already scolded that doctor. You should have done that the very first day. She's made a lot of trouble. I couldn't. I'm getting in trouble. But anyway, it does work. It's a very thing, but if you get anxious doing it, it's no anxiety, first of all. With mindfulness, wisdom, and then just a little bit of a smudge. Oh, it feels really good. Even if you're not anxious, a little bit of a smudge. It feels really nice. So that's it works. Simple. Do it yourself. You have no medication. Fine. You can be so relaxed. Dear Ajahn, is it true that when we go into the three metro, we could automatically know the three woeful claims: hell, animal, and ghost, and White House? We could realize that in this very life. Of course you could. But it's not just the bad states of existence are no longer open for you. I often wonder why? Why is it if you are a stream winner, basically you realize that there's no personality in there. There's no real self, no consciousness is in your will, aren't you? Seeing all of that, why does that mean that you won't go into the hell realms, the animal realms, or into the ghost realms? Why? And it all comes about what we call guilt. When is this ghost of me and mine will? You feel that you deserve to be punished sometimes because you hurt somebody or you punish yourself. which is one of the reasons why that we choose to go to Hellbounds. I don't know if any of you have read, I remember reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. It's why this fellow was executed in Russia. He killed his, not his landlady, but person loaning him some money. And that he actually, luckily, he got away with it. He was actually free, he would get caught. But his guilt and remorse was so strong, eventually he gave himself up to the police. But he was nice and blessed there on just how we all feel guilty. And so in the end, you know, we actually just almost admit our guilt. So anyway, because people feel that's the only way to overcome their sense of suffering, by being punished. But as a Buddhist, if you become a human, the idea of punishment just makes no sense at all. There's been enough suffering already, so why should we create more by punishing ourselves? Now that's an easy thing to say, but if it becomes human, it becomes an obvious solution to all problems. So I often say the gates of hell are always open. People in hell can either any time they want, any time they think they've had enough, and can forgive themselves. It's one of the reasons why forgiveness sounds so easy to do, but so hard to forgive yourself and forgive others. You're not such a bad person. As in, people always think, I don't know, you don't know me. Yes, I do. You're not such a bad person. You forgive yourself, you're okay. But it's very hard thing to do. Forgiveness and compassion are all links with faith and courage, he said to Jesus. That's compassion. That's why, because we can forgive ourselves. We don't need to punish ourselves by sending ourselves to hell. Question, although I meditate, I'm not truly happy. What's wrong? It's because when you're meditating, you want something. That's why you're not happy. There are two types of meditation called by the Buddha. Please don't, if I ask you a question, what are those two types? Please don't answer. It's always a trick question. Because there's two types of meditation. It's not samatha vipassana. It's second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. What is the second noble truth? Basic Buddhism. Wanting, craving is the cause of suffering. So if you are not happy when you're meditating, that must mean you're doing second noble truth meditation. Find out what it is you want. Then you find the answer. Why you suffer. The other type of meditation, third noble truth of meditation, renouncing, letting go, giving up. This is good enough. Being happy where you are. Just letting go of all wanting and craving. That leads to the bliss of Nirvana. The ultimate happiness. So if you're happy after meditating, well done, you've let go. But if you're still tense, struggling, it's because you wanted to get someone. You are striving. I don't usually tell this simile until later on in the retreat, but this is Ajahn Chah's simile of the mango orchard. You know that one? Some of you have heard it before. But this must have been the first few weeks or months I was at Wat Phra Kon, because I've forgot it for years, and so much of other people, because there wasn't any book, you know, which I saw. So I wrote it down in one of my books because it's powerful simile. He said his monastery was a mango orchard where the Buddha had planted the trees. And because of the Buddha's great wisdom and compassion, there are special mango trees. Every mango tree has thousands of ripe, sweet, juicy mangoes like you've never tasted before. But you cannot get those mangoes. First of all, I've got no rubbish teeth. Who was this monk I was taking refuge under? Made no sense at all. As a scientist, my experience was you'd have to wait for days, months for a mango to fall. And if it did, would it fall in your hand? No, of course not. Usually on your head. But that was actually so true. Being still, that's samadhi. Stillness, calmness. Sit absolutely still under the mango tree. You know, the great wisdom, bodhi tree, if you like. And hold out your hand. Open the door of your heart with kindness. And then a mango will come to you before. Oh, that's really goosebump type teaching, because that's how it works. If you go striving, looking for nirvana, looking for deep meditation, looking for nirvana, so right away. You see it perfectly still, with kindness, with openness. You'll find these things that just come to you. Dear Ajahn Bhav, five aggregates or five candles. The English translation doesn't make much sense to me. Is there a better translation for you?
Yes!
Because I've been busy trying to do translations, so I call it the five components of existence. Five components of existence. So that translation is my little book, Word of the Buddha, which I haven't published yet because it's still a work in progress, but if I keep trying to make it perfect, it's called Vedana. It comes from the verb Vedatya, which means the field of experience. So that's why I prefer calling it experience. And then we have the perception and sound. Just describe it. There are two people, aren't there?